This is DNFM. I'm Sam Solomon. DNFM features the latest stories in design and tech, brought to you by Designer News. Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 11. Today's guest has done product design and brand work for companies including Pinterest, Twitter, and Dropbox. Her writing has been featured in Fast Company, Offscreen Magazine, and numerous other publications. She's written one novel and is currently working on a second. My guest today is Ash Wong. She's part designer and part writer. She's the author of The Firesteel and is working on a new novel called Suspension. In this upcoming interview, we're going to talk a little bit about how she moved from brand design into product design. We'll also discuss what motivated her to become a novelist and what we can expect in her upcoming book. Hold tight because we've got a fantastic interview coming up. But first, we've got a word from our sponsor and a few announcements. Our sponsor for this episode of DNFM is Flow. Flow is simple project management software for teams who ship. Because Flow was built by designers, for designers, it's simple, beautiful, and easy to use. Every day, teams at Apple, Shopify, and TED, and thousands of others use Flow to manage projects, collaborate on tasks, and stay productive. With a brand new Slack integration, Flow makes it easier than ever to go from discussion to done by turning work chat into actionable tasks. To learn more and sign up for a 15-day free trial, visit getflow.com/signup. We've got a handful of featured job listings this week. Total is looking for a senior web designer, and that's a remote job. Google is looking for an interface designer for their VR division. That is in Mountain View, California. And finally, Bench is looking for a brand designer in Vancouver. And I think that about covers it. If any of these jobs sound interesting, if you're either hiring or looking for a new job, all of these and more are at designernews.co/jobs. My guest today is Ash Wong. Ash is an independent writer, designer, and illustrator based in San Francisco. She is the author of The Firesteel and has an upcoming book, Suspension. Additionally, Ash has worked on both brand and product design for companies such as Pinterest, Twitter, and Dropbox. Ash, it's great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Sam.
So I hope my introduction does you justice. You've done a ton of stuff and you're clearly a maker. I'm curious, though, like when people ask you, what do you do? What do you usually tell them?
Oh, it depends. Sometimes I'll just say I'm a designer when it's easier. If I'm talking to people who aren't in Silicon Valley, I think there's more of a like clarification that has to happen. Sometimes I've started saying artist now, which would give like 18-year-old Ash the shivers. But it's starting to be true. But yeah, it's a hard question because day to day, I don't really know how to answer that to myself sometimes.
Well, you know, the reason I ask you that is because one of your posts that I read, Don't Wait for the Blessing, you said that, you know, when it comes to titles, you kind of want to break the comma bank. You know, I'm curious why you say that and why that's important to you.
Well, I think particularly the thing that drew me to design in the first place was that there was this possibility of doing everything, but having kind of this unifying thread. So it's part of what draws me to writing as well, where you could be like designing for a sewing machine company, you could be designing for like Snapchat, you could be designing for anything. And so you can still keep learning and actually do all of these things and contribute, but at the same time, you're like really working on one craft. And since then, it's kind of expanded where I'm starting to see a big similarity between crafts. Like, I know the whole, like, should designers code thing? blowing up. I'm like, I don't know. My friend Sabrina is so funny. She was like, should designers write? Should designers research? Should designers do X, Y, Z? And it's like,
is the answer to all those yes?
If you want. It's just like, do what draws you. I think it can't hurt. You know what I mean?
Well, you said, you know, kind of there's like a single thread that you notice between kind of a lot of these professions or creative professions. Will you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, my main thing that I'm interested in is revealing what's there. So I mean, it's like clichely referred as like storytelling or, you know, but part of it is also just like making stuff easier for people to understand, making people feel comfortable. And I think there are so many ways to achieve that. And I think we really limit ourselves if we only say like, oh, well, I only do like information architecture for B2B sites. Well, it's just you limit yourself in what problems you can solve, because the problem might come along where I've seen plenty of problems where there's a project and they'll be like, oh, we need a designer and we need to do this. And then what I'm actually doing is like content management with someone at like 3 a.m. That has like nothing to do with like traditional design, but that's what the problem calls for.
Wow, and I really like,
sorry, go on.
I was like, I really like that. It limits the amount of problems you can solve. That's a really interesting way to look at it.
I mean, I know it's good to be a good craftsperson. I have like endless respect for people who are specialists, but for me personally, I'm just like so, like I can't help myself.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. If I'm not mistaken, you went to design school at Carnegie Mellon. Is that right?
True. Yep.
And did you go to college knowing you wanted to be a designer or a writer, or what were you trying to figure out? Were you trying to figure that out there?
So funnily enough, when I first went to Carnegie Mellon, I was determined that I was going to be an industrial designer. So I actually thought I was going to go to industrial design and maybe become like a video game concept artist, or at least, you know, just like draw stuff, make products. I don't know. But somewhere in my first year, so the way the school is structured is the first year everyone was together. They've since changed the program to be a little more modern, but at the time, and it was great, I loved it. Everyone was in one room. You didn't touch computers the first year. Everyone did the same assignments. So you're doing like drawing. We were made like marble Rube Goldberg machines and did all kinds of other stuff. And I had this realization where I was like, oh, at 3 a.m., what would I rather be doing? Would I rather be sanding wood, or would I rather be like poking letters on a computer? And that became, I was like, I would much rather be like poking letters on a computer.
Were computers looked down upon while you were in design school?
Not really. I think it was just, it adds a layer of complication when you're trying to learn basic concepts, which I actually agree with. A lot of the time, I think having too powerful a tool is really bad for you, and it just makes things too overwhelming. And so I really appreciated like the first couple assignments. We were drawing lines. We were drawing circles. We were like learning how to just draw basic shapes. And we were also kind of like developing the stamina to become good designers.
So I never went to design school. So when you say drawing basic shapes, could you elaborate on that a bit?
I think one of our assignments was to draw 100 lines.
Just like the constraint. You have a pen.
That was the assignment. Not even a pen. There, you had a Prismacolor pencil. So first of all, Prismacolor pencils, you can't drop them on the floor or else the lead shatters. And so like people would constantly be dropping. Like, you'd have to go to the store and buy like 5 extras. And there would always be that one kid in the class who like didn't buy enough extras. Or they were like looking for pencils from other people. And you would hear the like pencil drop and everyone's like, no. but yeah, like the assignments were really like you would draw a line, 100 lines, and you would like pin that up. And like the professor would be like, these lines are good, these lines are bad.
What is that entirely subjective? Is there something that makes lines really good?
Well, I mean, so the answer is it depends. But for that assignment, you want them very uniform.
Okay.
And so you would have to keep your, it would, you'd have to keep your tools in good condition, where like the pencil would have to be like just sharp and just so. But yeah, and they would have to be like straight and parallel. That was like a big part of it.
Well, and what, after you were done drawing lines, what were some of the other like exercises? What was step up from drawing a bunch of lines?
After drawing lines, you drew a bunch of lines to draw cubes. And there was always the fear, like we would, like one of our assignments was you have to draw like 3 perfect cubes. And they have to all be uniform and all look alike and be from the exact same perspective. And it has to be like a nice perspective. There's like certain perspectives that were like distracting because they were too uniform.
Wow, that sounds, as someone who has like really terrible handwriting, that sounds like a really big challenge.
Yeah, it was definitely really challenging. And I mean, you know, of course, some people were better at drawing than others, but I think everyone kind of left with the lesson of like design takes a long time and it takes discipline. And so like that was more a part of the lesson, I think, than like, I don't know, like decade later, everyone's who's actually drawing cubes now from my class, even who's in industrial design, like probably like three people, everyone just like fled to UI design. But I think the lesson was like kind of bigger than that.
So after the first year, when you were allowed to get a hold of a computer, what types of things were you doing then?
Well, we did not get to use color. So
it sounds like everything is a constraint.
Yes. Yes. And I think that was really healthy. There was a point where I think my whole class, I think James Victoria came to talk and everyone just like freaked out after and like totally rebelled. And they're like, we should quit school. It's so constraining. We need to like make giant wheat paste murals and so on. I still have his poster from his lecture because I thought that was like a really fun pivotal time for me. But anyway, before our class, like in the olden days, like long ago, people would actually spend the first 6 months of being a communication design major letter setting for the letterpress. So they would set like a paragraph, and that was like a big assignment. But we did stuff like we were like, make movie posters only using one font and only using spacing to indicate hierarchy. So we would be like, what about if you only use size to indicate hierarchy? What if you can use two typefaces? So it was like very like building upon building.
I see. It sounds like an interesting exercise.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's good. Even a practice designer could get a lot out of that exercise, I think.
After college, you took a job at Code and Theory in San Francisco. How did you end up there?
So I graduated during the recession, which was really fun.
San Francisco was cheaper then.
I know. That is true. It was still expensive. But I remember, I think my first apartment, I was like, $700 for a room? I was like, what is this madness? And now I like look back on that and I'm like, oh, how naive. But yeah, I don't know. I felt there was a lot of industry going on out here. I had some friends out here. Since it was a recession, I was calling like tons of agencies and they're all like, we just fired four people. So like probably we're not going to hire anyone, especially someone straight out of school. And I was like, okay. And just like kept going down the list. But yeah, I think I applied to about 60 places, which was like pretty fun.
But you really wanted to live in San Francisco.
Yeah, I love autumnal weather. And I was like, oh, San Francisco is like permanent autumn. So that was one reason, even though now that I've been here for a while, I'm like totally accustomed to it. I just like walked my dog and it was like 65 degrees out and I had like a puffy vest and this sweater on. And I was like, oh no, I was like spot the California resident. yeah, but I came out here and Code and Theory was a ton of fun. I did some like crazy, this is back in the era of like flash ads and flash banners. So I was doing some of that. That was like agency bread and butter. So you could do like the cooler projects, like websites and stuff. But yeah, that was a fun time. So I was there for a little while.
Were agencies the only type of company you were looking at? Were you looking at larger businesses or perhaps startups?
I think when I just got out of school, there was kind of this fetishization of boutique agencies where it's like, oh, that's like what you wanted to do after school, which is really funny because now even at Carnegie Mellon, all the kids want to go work at startups. That's like their thing now. They're like, oh yeah, we want to go work in tech. But like it was not that long ago and I still feel like no one was going to work at any of the tech companies. Like I had friends who would go and work and then people would be like, why would you go to that company and like work somewhere in-house? That's madness.
Is that it? The fear that you're locked into working on one product at one company or on one brand forever?
Yeah, I think that might have been part of it. I think it also, the idea of like what a designer is has changed a little bit over the years, which has been kind of interesting. I think agency design is very service oriented even still. There's still like this idea of like there's a discrete project and it needs to look awesome or like work really well or something. So you go and find a very attractive agency and get it done. Even though also now I think there's like a, we just are like overflowed. So our like full-time people can't handle it. So you see companies like Google and Facebook engaging with agencies, but, I think it is interesting in full-time roles at startups, particularly where designers have this demand of them now to be equally invested into the company as other employees.
And you don't think that that existed too long ago?
Yeah, I think there was still this idea that like design is entirely a service industry.
That's interesting. Well, so you left the agency world and did decide to go join one of those tech companies. Will you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so my first big tech job was at Twitter. And the reason I went there was team. I was very attracted to the team, and it was just like a very high concentration of great designers where I was like, oh, sick, I know this person from Dribbble, like back in the day. and everyone just seemed really nice. It seemed very optimistic. There can occasionally, not all agencies, but there can be like an air of like clients, like, God, we have to do more client work. And so I liked this idea of, first of all, kind of being like cutting out the middleman and just working directly for users. That was really attractive to me, as well as working with a bunch of people who are also like optimistic and excited to go design for human beings.
And so when you got to Twitter, what types of things were you doing then? Were you doing product stuff or brand design or what?
I was doing entirely brand design there. So one of the projects I did, it was kind of started off as like a hack project. So it was like entirely conceived by us, but we wanted to highlight stories about Twitter that were not just about, you know, like what did Lady Gaga have for breakfast, or, you know, which was like the joke about the whole, I don't know if the Dare's joke is like, oh, Twitter's just like what celebrities had for breakfast or things like that. Cause a lot of people were actually doing really interesting things with Twitter. And that was kind of the spirit of the platform, which is we gave users this tool and they continued to do like strange things with it, like invent at mentions and things like that. So, you know, we highlighted some stories. One, for instance, is this Japanese fisherman who would tweet his catch. And then by the time he got to shore, all his fish were sold. And he was like, cool. And I was like, that's a weird way to use Twitter. And that's awesome. but there's just like a lot of examples of that. So we were kind of highlighting that. I was doing internal things, you know, the normal like swag, t-shirts, I have a joke that I was like, between the years that I worked at Twitter and Pinterest, I closed like a quarter of Silicon Valley. So I did a lot of swag. There's a lot of swag involved.
That's funny. So when did you find an interest in product design?
I think it happened when I was at Pinterest. I was initially doing brand design at Pinterest as well, but I kept coming up against this invisible wall where, you know, you'd be like, oh, we have to solve this problem, but well, we're going to have to engage a product designer if we want to go all the way. So you can only go up to here. And I'd be like, well, that's frustrating. So things like new user experience is a really good example where that is a brand problem because somebody's coming in and they're like, what is this thing that I'm signing up for? Like, I don't want this. And you have to be like, no, you do want this because XYZ. And then like, let me collect all your info. So it becomes both the product and a brand problem combined in one. And so that was kind of the first time that I started being like, okay, like problems are more holistic than just brand or product. So if I want to be a brand designer, even an illustrator, like I should probably try to learn product from these talented people while I have the chance, and it'll only improve my brand design.
So what types of things did you learn from these product designers?
Oh man, that's a big question.
Let's break it down. What was one of the first things that you learned from one of Pinterest product designers?
One of the things that I learned that was a big thing, I was working with a researcher at the time. We were doing studies on people who had actually churned out of the service which is really interesting because normally a lot of those studies focus on people who are like obsessed with the product and they're like, oh, let's like replicate this success. But they're not really looking at like, oh, why are people leaving? Like what's the gulf between these people and like the people who are like diehard users? And so that was a really interesting thing because I think as a tendency, we, especially with like new user experience, we try to like design the whole experience and like make it as polished as possible and then like get it in front of people with the realization, of course, that like that's not the right thing. And then you have to like do it over and over again. So it's a lot of churn. And what we had figured out was that by doing some simple things that literally just would explain to somebody like what it is, we would see like higher results than all of these like crazy whirling doohickey things. And so from there, I was like, oh, you can test story. Like, that's really interesting. Because we're used to, you know, testing like, oh, this flow, is this going to work? Like, let's like do a mock-up, let's do some user tests. But I was like, no, you can test narrative.
So that is interesting.
Yeah, so we put up some simple slides and we were like, is this going to help at all? And like, it did, like double digit percent increases just by putting just like four slides that were like, here are instructions on like what this is. Not even instructions, we're like, this is what this is for. And people were like, oh, okay. And like would sign up and use it. It's weird.
Well, on the other hand, what do you think people that are product designers or primarily focus on the product can learn from brand designers?
It's funny because I think a product designer has way more control over brand than they think, because once someone signs up and they're not like getting marketing emails all of the time and they're not like, you know, looking at your site or like looking at your app screenshots, they're in your product. So the brand is the product. Like how they interact with you is actually like the portrayal of their brand to you. So like you get a brand like Instagram or something, for example, and she's like, oh, that's like a beautiful logo. And like, what a beautiful, you know, mini site or something. What beautiful blog posts. But really what people think of when they think of Instagram is like what they're seeing every day. So I know that they just released something to like deal with comments. If people are trolling, you can like delete words or something. I don't know if you saw this, but yeah, I mean like those features are the brand, you know, like releasing those features where like, oh, like, do you care about stopping harassment? Like, do you like respond to your users when they, and the support, like how do you respond to them?
You kind of see how users interact with the product as an extension of kind of like brand design type stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's very similar to, I think, environmental design. Like if you go into a store, like you can imagine if the store has like a beautiful facade and you're like, oh, sweet. Like these windows are beautiful. And you go in and it's just like an empty concrete box with like some stuff on the floor. You'd be like, what is this?
This is a trick, right?
Exactly. And then like you would remember the like empty boxes and you're like, that was weird. Like I thought the store was going to be something and like it didn't fulfill the promise. And so I think that's really what product design is like fulfilling the promise of the brand. Like as a brand designer, you could like sell and sell and sell a brand as like this holy thing. But if it's not delivering, the brand fails. Like that is brand design.
I'd like to switch gears a bit here. So Ash, you've written a novel, this fictional book, The Fire Steel. I'm curious, what possessed you to write a novel?
It is funny. I always tell people that I didn't really have a strong reason to do it, which I think was actually in retrospect a good thing. I always say that I think because I didn't have a strong reason to do it, I didn't have a strong reason not to do it. So no one could convince me not to do it, which is like a weird paradox. But there was a real turning point for me where I decided to actually write the novel, which was I love to read. So I read a lot. I try to read a book a week. I try. I don't succeed. And I was reading this really good book. I don't remember which book it was, but I remember thinking to myself, I was like, oh, I wish I could be a writer. And then I just flashed back to all these times where people were like engineers or other people would be like, oh, I wish I could be a designer. And I'd be like such a brat. I'd be like, you could be a designer. Just like put in your 10,000 hours and then you'll just like be it. It's just like learning some rules. And then of course they're just like, I'm not, no,
10,000 hours is a lot.
Yeah, it's just like not an appropriate answer. And so when I found myself being like, oh, I really love books, I wish I could write a book, but I can't, I was just kind of like, well,
10,000 hours.
Yep. So it was kind of like a dare at first just to see. And then, you know, I was always like, you know, if you don't like it, you can stop. But I really liked it. I found a lot of kinship between learning to write and learning design. Like a lot of the concepts carry over, or even things like contrast or hierarchy or like portraying the overall vision, you know, creating this universe. It is very similar in a lot of ways. So,
I mean, so were you driven just by the fact that you felt like this was something like that you needed to prove to yourself that you could become a writer? Because, you know, it's not like a like 20 or 30 page thing. Like it actually is. It's like a full book. So there, yeah. I feel like there had to be something else that was like pulling you to try and finish this thing.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of it is, I think I've read enough things that I have an idea, like a vague idea of the sorts of things I want to read, where I'm like, oh, I really would love to read this type of thing. I haven't seen that before. And so I think I just get the itch where I'm like, oh, I want to like talk about this thing that isn't being talked about. And I'm like, well, if you want that, you should just like write it so it exists and then you'll have it. And I was like, okay. But I also like this idea of creating content. I feel like my design career has like gone into this like weird spiral of like getting more and more into things where it's like, you know, I was in brand design, but then I was like, but you know, I want to like know how like the product works and like how to do product design. So I like burned into that. And then I was like, wait, I want to know about the content stuff that like fills these boxes that I'm making. So I'm like burrowing into that. And so like, I don't know what I'm going to burrow into next, but that's kind of been the path.
I mean, to me, it seems like it's just your own curiosity that kind of sends you down these rabbit holes.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a saying that people have where they're like, oh, I love having written, but I don't like writing. And I was just like, no, I like writing. So like, I just like still find it really enjoyable, just as I find like usually doing design or art stuff enjoyable.
Since this is a podcast, would you describe the cover of your book, The Fire Steel?
Sure. So it's kind of got this California burned out gradient where it's like blue and red. And the title of the book is The Fire Steel. So it's kind of keying off of this theme that I have going through the book of like hot and cool color contrast. It's kind of like seen between like day and night, like passion and coolness, memory and nostalgia. So it kind of keys off of that. And then I cut these letters out of paper and kind of like pushed them up so that they have like the counter displayed. This might be hard to explain, but I did that to kind of emulate this feeling of firelight without it actually being shadows. So it's like a weird typographic treatment that harkens back to that without being directly it.
Was that something that was difficult to do, like as a designer?
So the actual doing of it probably took me like 5 minutes, but I had been going through this exercise where while I was writing the book and like figuring out what the heck I was doing, I was also using my like visual sense to figure out what the book would look like to give me a better idea of like what the book would feel like. If that makes sense.
So you went through several iterations of this.
I did. And I was just like busting out covers. The first ones are like very confused. So you can tell I like don't really know what the book sounds like yet. I don't really know what the themes are. And you can actually see in this instance, my progression of solidifying how the book feels by like the covers. Cause they get better and better and like more unified. Cause they're like all over the place in the beginning. I had one, like somebody was like, this one looks like Mission Impossible. I was like, ugh.
That's what you were going for, right?
I know. Another one, I was like joking. I was like, this is the Miami Vice cover, you know, which was just like, I was like, oh gosh, I'm lost, but it's okay. We'll just muddle through until we get there.
Well, so now you're in the process of writing another book called Suspension, right?
Yes.
Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It takes place, I like to say, in a 2018 very similar to ours. So it is a post-apocalyptic sort of, but it's not apocalyptic, and it's like in the near future. And so it just examines if, like, you know, it's stuff in America is kind of sketchy right now. So it kind of examines if, like, just a couple things go bad, like, what would happen? And it starts out, it's like life isn't actually that different from what it is. Everyone's still on their phones. Everyone's, like, looking at their tweets for news and all these things. And, you know, the media is still manipulating us, if you believe in the media manipulating us and all of these things. And, you know, all this violence and, you know, inequity is still happening in our world. But it's just kind of like examined, like, well, let's take it like a notch further of like all these like doomsday scenarios, like what happens if they happen?
Well, there's a really great paragraph in kind of, I guess it was your announcement post or article for Suspension that I'd like to take a second to read.
Okay.
I don't know what comes next for America. The GOP and DNC are destroying themselves. Political debate has peaked into pure character assassination, and news is entertainment. I wrote Suspension to peer through the door of Together We Stand, Divided We Fall. Because I suspect that divided we fall, are divided, we do not fall. There would be no crash, no satisfying bonfire to send off the United States of America. And to me, when I read that, the phrase that really stuck out in my mind is divided, we do not fall. I'm wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at history, even as a lesson, there's been tons of places that quote unquote fell. You know, you look at the Roman Empire, like the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines. I was just like at the Hagia Sophia and like looking at all the stuff where like civilizations would just like fall completely apart, quote unquote, but like people just kept living. There's always like something after. It's just in human nature to survive. So I think we keep banking on this big event where, oh, it's going to get so bad where everyone's going to be like, you know what? We need to band together and figure something out and do something. But I think those two things are independent of each other, where it's like we can decide to band together and to do something and to actually make progress, but we shouldn't be relying on some like giant apocalyptic event to happen, because that's just going to happen and like we're just going to probably keep going.
So either way, there has to be a way forward.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like waiting for this event does no one any good.
Well, so, you know, I'm curious, now that, you know, you've published your first book and are working on your second one, how is this book different? What are you doing differently this time around?
So this book feels pretty risky to me. There is a lot that is not comfortable for me, which is good, but also very scary. The first book was a lot of me figuring out like what I was actually doing at all, where I was like, how do you write a book? Like, what is a character? Like, you know, like what, how many themes are too many? You know, how many themes are not enough? What, like, do I write, how do I write characters that aren't passive? So a lot of it was like that. And, so it's pretty easy for me to write that book in terms of themes and like ideas and so on. This book feels a lot riskier to me because I think it takes a little more of a stand. There's a lot more things that are contentious. 'Cause the first one, it's like, oh, I think this book is too saccharine, or like, I think it's like, blah, I don't like love stories. It's, you know, things like that where you're like, okay. But this one is, there are political themes in this one. So there's like a pretty good chance of offending somebody, or like somebody being like, that's not how the world actually is, or like, that's not how I see the world. So there's a little more of a stand in this one where it's less like, oh, this is just my little world floating off in the corner, to like where I'm actually saying something about America, which is scary.
But don't you think that by being contentious or being on the edge, there's certain people that'll be more attracted to that?
Oh, of course. And I think that's great. I think also there is this battle that I fight with myself where it's like, it just needs, it's like a story that needs to be told, and it's something that like I want to talk about. And so I think there is like a dearth of this idea being really talked about in meaningful ways. And so if we talk about it, that's like great.
You know, and so one of the things I am curious, you talked about, you know, a lot about writing, but, you know, I started my career in journalism. I've exclusively written nonfiction maybe since I was in elementary school or something. I'm curious, where do these stories and plots and characters, where do they come from? Where is the inspiration for that?
It's funny. I was talking to a friend the other day and I was like, I need to stop writing this book because every time I write something, something happens in the real life and I'm like, oh, come on.
Oh, it's not like it's not fiction anymore.
Yeah. Like, I mean, so one of the big scandals is, you know, raising the price of medication to like being way more than, it costs to produce. And of course that's happened. That happened with like the Martin Shkreli stuff and so on. But recently the EpiPen thing happened when I picked up the draft again. I was like, this is like a curse. This is like that like Stranger Than Fiction thing where it's like everything happens when I do that. And then like, you know, there's like a virus in the book and like Zika virus broke out. And then so I think it's just, to me, it's obviously not happening because I'm writing this book. Like that's not what's going on at all. But I think it's, to me, a sign that it is keying off of kind of fears and insecurities that are widespread. It's keying off of the state that like the world is actually in. So it is fiction, I'm trying to make it very true, if that makes sense.
It definitely does. Well, we're at about 35 minutes or so here. I've got, you know, one last question for you, and I'm curious, between your writing, your freelance work, your other projects, are you creatively satisfied doing all of these things?
I think so. yeah, I mean, I loved working full time and I love, you know, working with people on like helping people get their products understood and out there and helping people. But I think it was working on my own things that gave me creative fulfillment. I know a lot of people who get creative fulfillment from working for people. And I'm always like, I envy that. That's great. But for me, that was never going to be the answer. So like this hybrid model of working with people and helping and trying to be not a burden on society while also kind of scratching the itch of like, what if, what is the story? What's going on? It's been creatively fulfilling for me.
Well, Ash, I appreciate you joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
You too, Sam.
And that's going to be it for episode 11. If you're enjoying DNFM, make sure to subscribe. We're on iTunes and SoundCloud. And if subscriptions aren't your thing, you can always listen on the web at designernews.co/podcast. If you have any comments or feedback about the show, please reach out to us. You can find Designer News on Twitter at @designernewsbot or me personally at Samuel R. Solomon. We'd love to hear what you think. If you're interested in supporting the show, please get in touch with us about sponsorship opportunities. Once again, my guest is designer and writer Ash Wong. I'm Sam Solomon, and this is DNFM.